Welcome to ForTruth.net, a ministry of the North American Mission Board. I'm Rob Bowman, Manager of Apologetics and Interfaith Evangelism. Our mission is to equip people in our churches to be able to share with others the reasons for the hope that is within them as they seek to reach North America for Jesus Christ. Today I'm speaking with Daryl Bach, Research Professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary. Dr. Bach is a past president of the Evangelical Theological Society, a corresponding editor for Christianity Today, and the author of several excellent books, including Jesus According to Scripture, Breaking the Da Vinci Code, and his recent book, The Missing Gospels. Dr. Bach, it's my pleasure to welcome you to ForTruth.net.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
And I'd like to talk to you today about those so-called missing gospels. We've been hearing a lot about them lately. The ones that I seem to hear about the most would be the Gospel of Thomas, or should I say the Gospels of Thomas, since there seem to have been more than one, the Gospel of Peter, and even the Gospel of Judas, which has gotten a lot of press recently. Most of the public has never read any of these Gospels, but they do have this vague idea that somehow they've been recently discovered, and we now have these Gospels and now realize that they overturned the biblical view of Jesus that we find in the New Testament Gospels. So I'm going to pick your brain about these extra or so-called missing Gospels. Let me begin by asking you about some of the biblical scholars today who are heralding these non-canonical Gospels as revolutionizing our understanding of Christianity. Two of them who come to mind, we seem to hear from a lot, are Elaine Pagels, who teaches religion at Princeton University, and Bart Ehrman, who teaches religion at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Could you explain to us what these scholars and others like them are claiming today about these different Gospels, and why are these claims important for us as Christians to understand?
Well, the basic premise is that for years, the only story about Christianity that was being told was the one that came through the biblical materials and the materials of the Orthodox Church of the early centuries, and that history is written by the winners, and so the losers never got a chance to speak, nor did we understand what their role was in the history of early Christianity. And so when we discovered texts written by these losers, the texts are known as the Nag Hammadi texts. They were found in Egypt. All of a sudden, we got direct access to these sources, and in getting direct access to these sources, we were put in a position of being able to understand what they taught, and potentially, at least the argument goes, that what we see is an alternative to Orthodox Christianity that was competing with it from the earliest time. So whether you're listening to Bart Ehrman or reading his book on lost Christianities, or reading Elaine Pagels, either the Gnostic Gospels or Beyond Belief, or hearing Marvin Meyer on many specials. He's been on lately on two specials, one on ABC and one on CNN. And they start talking about alternative Christianities, or that there were multiple Christianities from the beginning. That's what they're arguing for, and they're using these new finds as a basis to make the argument.
Now, as I understand it, there's a couple things about these alternative Christianities, as Ehrman has called them, or these different Gospels, that these scholars are finding appealing. One is that they simply differ from the New Testament in certain significant ways, and they are claiming that since these other books represent a different interpretation of Jesus, a different interpretation of Christianity, there is no one authoritative, true, historically accurate, or theologically appropriate interpretation of Christianity. And therefore, people who want to name the name of Jesus, who want to be in Christian churches or in Christian institutions, but have a dislike for Orthodox Christianity, they're perfectly fine doing that. That it doesn't really matter because there have always been alternative interpretations of Christianity, and so if we come up with new ones today, well, that's fine because that's the way it's always been. That's the first thing I've heard, and then the second thing that I seem to hear is that these scholars claim that these alternative Gospels present if I could use or misuse a common expression these days, a kinder, gentler Jesus, a Jesus who is more enlightened, more pluralistic, more tolerant, more open-minded to other beliefs, perhaps more more in keeping with the spirit of the age today, really, and so perhaps more enlightened in his view of women, we're sometimes told, and so therefore they're excited about these gospels, these other books, because they seem to validate certain attitudes, certain values that modern people would like to have today that they think are incompatible with affirming the New Testament version of Christianity. Would those be accurate understandings of why these gospels are being touted, or is there something else that we should know about as well?
No, that's basically, it's all the above. You're dealing with an attempt to argue for diversity in the earliest Christianity that fits with the emphasis in our culture that wants diversity of religious expression, not only within Christianity, but across all the religions. And then secondly, your kinder, gentler Jesus is a Jesus who really doesn't make himself the issue in these extra-biblical gospels, but a kind of knowledge about who we are becomes the center of the faith. This is not a faith about the cross or sin or redemption in those senses of the term. This is a faith about finding the divine spark within us, developing the knowledge that we are spiritual beings and thus should respond spiritually to the world, and that's it. And so it's those differences that both they promote and, on the other hand, that make this material so different than Orthodox Christianity, and which also, ironically enough, explains why this material was never widely accepted in the earliest period of the church, which is something to highlight, because the claim is that this existed alongside the church, and oftentimes the suggestion is that they were competing pluralities as opposed to one approach being the majority versus the other.
Now, let me ask you this question, because I think it is important to address this particular aspect of the debate. Are these other gospels more enlightened, more sophisticated, perhaps? You know, are they superior in their view of women, for example, which I think is a question that has got to be important to a lot of people today? We're told that the New Testament is a product of a patriarchal culture, and somehow the Gnostic Gospels, or the whatever you want to call these other Gospels, are sometimes regarded as being more enlightened. Well, let's put that to the test. Would that be true, let's say, in their view of women? Would that be true in their view of the supernatural? Are they more enlightened books?
No, again, this is one of the areas where the representation of the text really doesn't reflect the material itself. And it's a double misrepresentation. On the one hand, it's a misrepresentation of the biblical materials, which do a lot of affirming of the role of women, particularly against the cultural background. Mary sits at the feet of Jesus when they're dining with Martha. It was debated whether women should be taught. Jesus is clearly comfortable doing that with her. The disciples who followed Jesus clearly included women who were affirmed in that role, again, something that would have been unusual for the culture. Women were the first witnesses to Jesus' resurrection, something that would be completely unprecedented, and as an aside, would be a reason why that story was never created, because in the culture, women couldn't be witnesses, so you wouldn't create a story where the first witnesses really don't count as legal witnesses. That must be because it happened that way. So women were affirmed in the Bible in a very significant way vis-a-vis the culture. That's the first half of the response. But the second half is that if you actually look at this extra-biblical material, women, it is true that women play a role in the deity and that women are sometimes affirmed as being disciples of Jesus in a positive way, as Mary Magdalene is when it's clear that Jesus has respect for her as a disciple. But this is what it doesn't tell you. In the Gospel of Thomas, one of the more famous of these texts, in saying 1:14, the saying is put forward that unless a woman becomes a male, she can't enter into the kingdom of God. That's not very female-affirming. And if you look at another passage, and this is one that never gets brought up, in many of these Gospels, the key to the theology is their story of creation. And the key to their creation story is that the creation is corrupt from the beginning, the product of a second-tier or third-tier God, not the direct creation of God himself, not good at the beginning. And in many of these versions, it actually is the female deity who is responsible for the botched creation. So that's not very affirming either. It's a little bit like my saying to my wife, you know, this is all your fault, and it always has been.
I think that many people simply give these apocryphal, these extra-biblical gospels a pass when it comes to these aspects of their teaching about women, for example, when they would never do that for, let's say, the writings of the Apostle Paul, because who actually has a much more enlightened view of women, because they have an agenda, and I really honestly think they don't want the facts to get in the way of their agenda. So I've read scholars who are enamored of these Gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas, engage in exegetical gymnastics to explain away Thomas 1:14, which you just cited, and say that, well, actually, this has to be interpreted esoterically. It doesn't mean that females literally will become males. And they would never take that approach to something in the Gospel of Luke or in 1 Corinthians, you know. But when it comes to these other Gospels, these other writings, because they've already decided that they want to promote them as alternatives to the biblical Christianity, they go through all kinds of motions to try to explain away the unenlightened parts.
Well, I think that's correct. And I think the interesting part of this is the selectivity. You know, part of the reason a lot of people will give this material a pass is because of what they're told about these materials. I'm not talking about the scholars now, but the people who hear what's coming from the scholars. And that is, this stuff is new, which in one sense is true, in the sense of we now have our hands directly on these texts. The only way we knew about them before was through the reports of the critiques of the apostolic fathers writing in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries. And then the second aspect that causes them to give a pass is that the material that is cited selectively enough that they're made to sound more attractive than they actually are. And my solution for that problem is simply to encourage people to actually read this stuff. If they will actually read it and look at it, they will see, for the most part, very quickly that it is very uneven. That there are some passages that you read and you go, well, that's an interesting thought and may actually be, you know, an interesting piece of wisdom or something like that. But other parts of it are either so nonsensical or so distinct or so outlandish that you would go, well, you'd never embrace this work as a whole because of this kind of material. And so my view is that it is the exposure to this material, the direct exposure to this material, that oftentimes best explains it and best shows people what they're really dealing with. You know, the mantra is of this new school that history is written by the winners, but there's a reply to that mantra, and that is that sometimes the winners deserved to win. And that's the case in this particular case.
Let's talk about these different books, Inside the New Testament and Outside, in some kind of chronological context. Could you tell us, basically, you know, when the New Testament Gospels and the other New Testament books were written, and how does that compare with books like the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Judas?
Well, the New Testament books all come from the first century. There's unanimous agreement that the books of the New Testament are first century documents. You will only get a rare disagreement with that idea. There also is agreement that the Gospels themselves, the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are written either by apostles or by people very close to the apostles. Now, conservatives will say that Matthew and John go back to the apostles, generally speaking, but they recognize that Mark is written by someone who walked with Peter, and Luke is written by someone who had close contacts with Paul, among others. In fact, the belief is that Luke had a lot of
contacts in the early church. More moderate people may not accept those apostolic connections for Matthew and John, but they will accept the idea that Matthew and John are the product of what is often called the Matthean or the Johannine schools. These would be a line of tradition that would go back to John or would go back to Matthew. So there's among the bulk of New Testament people, there's agreement at least at that level, and everyone puts those works in the first century. Some will put them after A.D. 70. Some will put, particularly the Synoptic Gospels. Conservatives tend to put the Synoptic Gospels before A.D. 70. Everyone tends to put John in the 90s. So that's the situation with the biblical materials. These extra-biblical texts, for the most part, are 2nd and, in some cases, 3rd century texts. They're further on down the road. The earliest one of them is the Gospel of Thomas, 114 alleged sayings of Jesus. A very interesting text, because you read it, and about a quarter of it you read, and you go, that sounds like the biblical materials, because it does reflect what you see in the Bible. Another 25% of those sayings you read, and you go, that sounds pretty close to what's in the Bible, because it is pretty close to what's in the Bible. And then another 50% you read, and you go, I've never seen or heard that before, and that's because it isn't at all like what you see in the Bible. And so it's the mixed character of the Gospel of Thomas, some of which may actually reach back into the same traditions that you see, at least some of it, that you see in the biblical materials that has created the fascination with that gospel. But it still is, in its production, a second century text. And then the other gospels that we talk about and you hear about, particularly the Gospel of Judas most recently, are second century works. They are Gnostic works. They are a full 30 to 50 years removed from the timing of the biblical gospels, and this is the most important point. None of those texts have any kind of clear line back to the apostolic circle. And so they don't have the genealogical roots that one would need to have in order to say, well, this material really has a chance of being in contact with the real Jesus.
Well, let's talk specifically about the Gospel of Thomas. Elaine Pagels has argued that Thomas was written perhaps a little bit before the Gospel of John. She tends to view the Gospel of John as a response to the Gospel of Thomas, or at least to the ideas that are in that book. On what basis does she draw that conclusion? Is there anything to that?
No, I really don't think there is. I do think that the problem that you've got with Thomas is that it's not as explicitly Gnostic as some of these other Gospels. And Gnosticism, at least as a developed system, the type of story of creation that I've talked about, that kind of thing, does seem to emerge clearly in the second century. And Thomas lacks that. And so some people say, well, see, this isn't Gnostic. It's really more a reflection of Jewish wisdom and that kind of thing. And so it's a little bit earlier. I actually think what you're seeing in Thomas is, as I mentioned, there are various streams of oral tradition that are the sources for Thomas that are going into it, some of which are very old because some of them overlap with the biblical tradition stream. And so sometimes a person will appeal to that layer of the tradition as a way of saying the gospel is old, or at least as old as the synoptic gospels. But to do that, you've got to ignore the other layers of tradition that are also feeding into the Gospel of Thomas that give evidence of being later. And so she really is unusual in trying to get the date back that early. Like I say, most people who work with the Gospel of Thomas date its final construction and formulation to the early part of the second century.
Now, is this basically the problem with Bart Ehrman's argument as well, which
has
to do with the Q material?
Similar problem, that's right. All these attempts to push Thomas back don't do a good enough job of distinguishing between the tradition that is feeding into the material and the date of the gospel itself as a collection, and that's where I think the issue comes in. And then they turn that around and take that gospel and say, see, we've got an early gospel. There's another kind of Christianity here. Well, in fact, in one sense, they are right. The gospel does give evidence of another kind of Christianity that's out there, but two questions need to be asked. When was this gospel produced? So when did the community to which it is written, when did that exist? And how prevalent was this view? That's the other part that has to be asked. And the general, I think, response is that this is a lighter work. The community, therefore, is lighter. And therefore, however large the group was, however great the alternative was, if you will, we're into the second century. We're not in the first century. So the issue of when this diversity exists is probably the most important question to ask. And usually when you see this material on television or it's written about, that question is not clearly pursued.
It seems to me that if you, as we read the New Testament, in particular in Paul's epistles, that there is evidence during Paul's day of the development, we might call them, of some alternative versions of Christianity.
Absolutely.
But they don't look like the kinds of Christianity we find in the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Peter. They don't look Gnostic, at least maybe some things that might have some relationship, but they look more, some of them look more Judaizing, that is, they look like they're trying to bring the Christian religion back to something that looks more like straightforward Messianic Judaism, Judaism with Jesus added to it, or they look like something that's just very different than what you find in these second century Gospels.
I think that's true. That, you know, the problem here is that Gnosticism itself is a combination of Greek philosophy and Christian symbolism, and actually Neoplatonism. And the characteristic, the key characteristic of Platonism is this division, this dualism between the spiritual world and the material world. And Plato believed that the real and the ideal was in the spiritual, and all the earthly models were imperfect models. Well, Neoplatonism heightens that distinction. That's why the creation is not good at the beginning for Gnosticism. Well, there are elements of Neoplatonism that predate Gnosticism, and just as Platonism predates Gnosticism. So, for example, in 1 Corinthians, when you get this debate that Paul is clearly dealing with, that some people don't believe in a bodily resurrection, in chapter 15. This is not dealing with Gnosticism. This is dealing with the general Greek hesitation to believe that there's such a thing as a bodily resurrection. The Greeks at most believed that your spirit went somewhere, or that you died and you became some kind of a shadow, but they didn't believe in any physical element to the resurrection, and that's what Paul is fighting in 1 Corinthians 15. Well, some interpreters will look at that and they'll label it Gnosticism or incipient Gnosticism or something like that, and it might be incipient Gnosticism, but it's not the type of thing that you're seeing in these extra-biblical Gospels, where there's this whole theology of creation that is a part of the story that you don't see being engaged directly anywhere in the New Testament, which is one of the reasons why we think it's light, why this Gnosticism is lighter.
Now, it seems to me that, you know, when we talk about Gnosticism, it might be good to define the term, but as you point out in your book, the word really is difficult to define, and I think it's gotten thrown around so much that it's beginning to lose its punch or its value as a quick descriptive label. What do people usually mean by Gnosticism, and why is this a term difficult to define?
Well, the term, actually, I don't think is difficult to define. I think some people are complaining about the term because they want to get away from it, because they lose the contrast then. The argument is for doing away with the term is that there's enough variety in what we see in the second century that we can't speak of a Gnosticism. Now, that's probably true, but what these varieties all reflect is this kind of dualism that we've talked about between matter and spirit. There's the idea of a lesser God doing the creating. There's the creation of this whole host of luminaries that function as gods in the world. It's really a kind of, how do I want to say this, veiled polytheism. There's the idea that the body is not good and will not be redeemed. There's the idea that salvation has to do with the identification of who you are as a created entity, as opposed to having anything to do with redemption and sin that's associated with Jesus. So you take these four or five differences, and you've got Gnostic Christianity on the one hand versus Orthodox Christianity on the other, and the differences are so fundamental. This is the point. The differences are so fundamental that anyone coming out of a Jewish background to embrace Christianity, which is its earliest roots, would never have entertained the kinds of thinking that you see in Gnostic Christianity. Gnosticism is fundamentally anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic in its view of God and the creation, and it never would have been embraced early on as an expression, a natural outgrowth of the Jewish movement.
You know, I think this is really perhaps the most important basic difference between the New Testament Gospels and these other so-called missing Gospels. And one thing that I just can't help noticing as I read them is when I read the New Testament Gospels, and of course the rest of the New Testament as well, I find them dripping with Jewish quotations, Jewish allusions to the Old Testament, references to Jewish institutions, Jewish practices, you know, the temple and the tabernacle and the sacrifices and, you know, Moses and David and Abraham. And it's full, it's rich with allusions as well as direct quotations from the Old Testament. The entire New Testament seems to be pervasively suffused with Old Testament thought. And then I read these other Gospels, and it's like the Old Testament hardly even existed. Maybe, in fact, I think you have essentially touched on this already, that the perspective of these Gnostic Gospels is opposed to what you find in the Old Testament.
Exactly right. And so if I can have a little fun with a famous movie, it's a little bit like temples and sacrifices and Sabbaths, oh my, you know, you know, there, you don't see any direct engagement with the Jewish roots of Christianity, and where you do see that engagement, it's decidedly negative.
And of course, Jesus and all of his original disciples, I mean, it just seems so obvious, I'm embarrassed to have to remind people, but they were all Jewish.
Exactly right. And so the idea that the creation could come from a third-tier God and that the creation would be botched runs up against the very opening of the Bible, which was part of the sacred Torah of Judaism. That never would have even been accepted or contemplated. So when I get the question, what about those other Gospels? You know, sometimes you have a conversation and people will bring up what I call conversation stoppers. What about all those Gospels that never got in? Well, the simple answer is they never got in because their theology would have immediately been seen as being out of whack with the Jewish roots of Christianity that start with the creation.
I just think that is so fundamental, and I appreciated the fact that you pointed out that it really, at bottom, there's a kind of anti-Semitism at work here.
That's right. That's right.
Now, let's talk about a little bit more about what these Gospels say about Jesus. You've already touched on what they've said about God and creation. They have a non-monotheistic view of God and his relationship to the world. Well, a lot of people in our culture have the impression that what's really cool about these Gospels that didn't make it into the New Testament is that they have a different view of Jesus in that, supposedly, they present Jesus as just kind of an ordinary Joe or maybe a great man who was inspired, who was, you know, some kind of wise sage. But they think that these Gospels present a purely or strictly human Jesus in contrast to the divine Son of God view of Christ that you have in the New Testament. And, of course, a lot of people today would love to embrace a Jesus who was just one of us, a regular guy who kind of made it, spiritually speaking, and showed us the way, but he's just one of many ways, and he's just at bottom just a human being. Because that eliminates the idea of the exclusivity of the claims of Jesus Christ. Now, is this an accurate understanding in the popular culture about these non-canonical Gospels?
Well, I think it is the emphasis that you sometimes see, although, again, depending on who's saying it, that might be said with more care. Certainly Dan Brown's emphasis in the Da Vinci Code was that Jesus is presented as a human being in these Gospels that got rejected, and it was the fact that these Gospels had a divine Jesus that caused them to be accepted and way down the line in the 4th century. Other scholars will be much more careful about this. They will acknowledge that these extra-biblical Gospels all have a transcendent Jesus. He may not be as exalted as he is in the New Testament, but he's not merely a human being. And this is certainly clear in the most important of these texts. In the Gospel of Thomas, there are two key sayings. There's one saying 13 and one saying 77, both of which have an exalted Jesus. And one, Jesus says, "I am the all. Split a piece of wood, I am there. Lift up a piece of rock, and I am there." That doesn't sound like something you could say about a human being. And then in saying 13, when Thomas's confession of Jesus is commended, it's because he says he cannot describe who Jesus is. There's no way to put it into words. Well, again, this is not the description of a normal human being. So these texts have an exalted Jesus. In fact, the unusual thing to find in these texts is anyone who sees Jesus as just human. In fact, the only group of texts that I'm aware of that tries to do this are the texts by the Ebionites, who are Jewish in background and so want to keep to the one God. They seem to have held a view of Jesus that made him a great figure, but something less than divine. But we don't have actually any of their materials. What we know about them is only what's been reported about them.
So the Gnostic Gospels tend, as it were, to downplay, diminish, or even deny the full humanity of Jesus. Is
exactly
that correct?
Right. In fact, there are other texts, like in the Apocalypse of Peter, where Jesus is seen laughing in heaven in a vision that Peter has while the crucifixion is going on, and Peter asks him about it, and Jesus replies saying, "Well, what happened is basically that the substitute went to the cross, but they thought they were crucifying me," and of course he's laughing because he's faked them out. Now that's a very different view of the cross from what we're used to in Orthodox Christianity.
It is, but it's not all that dissimilar to the view of Jesus that we find in Islam.
Well, to the extent that it wasn't Jesus himself who was crucified, that's true.
And is there possibly, and this is sort of outside of what we were planning to talk about, but is it possible that there's some historical roots of the Islamic view that Jesus didn't go to the cross but merely ascended?
I get asked that question all the time, and it's conceivable to the extent that the place where these Gospels had the most influence are in parts of the Middle East out of which Islam emerged. But there's no direct connection that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But the idea that these ideas were out there floating around as kind of an alternative way to view the cross, that definitely is out there.
So in these Gnostic Gospels, then, there is not a belief in Jesus dying as an atoning sacrifice for sin, nor is there a belief in his physical resurrection. Would that
correct.
Be correct?
But on both points, and the reason for it is, I mean, Gnostic theology is actually pretty consistent. The reason for it is that the belief is that the problem with existence is in the flawed nature of the creation, not a problem within us. And so there's no need to deal with sin because the problem's not in us other than our ignorance of understanding who we are as spiritual beings. The problem is in the creation. So the problem's everywhere else. And so there's no need for sin. There's no need for redemption of our inner being other than to understand that we're spiritual beings. And so there's no need for the cross. And there's no physical resurrection because the material world is not worth redeeming.
It seems to me that almost all non-Christian religions, I should say outside of Judaism and Christianity, it seems to me that almost all of them, in one way or the other, and of course they differ in the way that they do this, but it seems that in one way or another, they all basically say, our problem is we just are ignorant of what we really are. We don't know the rules, or we don't realize that we're really divine. We don't realize where we came from. We've lost our way. And the way back is information. If we just knew the truth,
yeah,
we'd
I
fix
think
it.
That's true, although I think that in fairness, for Islam, what you would have to say is that what Muslims believe is that you just need to submit to God, period. I mean,
right.
And so, but most every other system is the idea of you know, if you just get your act together, you know, then you'll be in touch with God.
Right. And I think in Islam, the difference is that God is viewed as this personal being to whom people are accountable. But again, what Muslims are basically told is, if you know what God wants you to do, you can go out there and do it and fix your own problem.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What really distinguishes biblical Christianity from practically every other religion, certainly every major religion that I know of, is this idea that we are spiritually unable to fix our own problem, to restore ourselves to a relationship with God. And so God has had to act graciously in the incarnation and in the death and resurrection of Jesus to restore us to him.
That's right. And, of course, the roots of that go back into the Jewish picture of sin and sacrifice and uncleanness that is the reflection of the fact that we live in a way, oftentimes, that's dishonoring to God.
Now, I'd like to go back and ask you about a statement that you quoted from the Gospel of Thomas, and I've seen this too, where Jesus says something like, split a piece of wood and I am there.
Uh-huh.
Now, I may be misreading this, but that sounds to me like a form of pantheism. It sounds to me like he's saying, I'm under the rock, I'm in the wood, I'm kind of everywhere, but in a sense, anybody could say that if pantheism is true. So I'm wondering if that statement really is a claim of some kind of unique or exclusive or exalted status, or if he's really saying once you really understand who you are, you find yourself everywhere.
Well, it's discussed whether that passage is a statement of panentheism, where God is in everything, and as long as you're connected to the divine, you're connected to it, that kind of thing, or whether this is a unique statement about Jesus in particular. My own take is that when Jesus says he is the all, okay, which is in the same passage,
right?
He is saying more than that. If you as a spiritual being get wrapped up into the all and you become a part of it, then you're associated with that. But there seems to be some type of unique pointing that Jesus is into. But it is debated by scholars on Thomas whether Jesus is simply saying, I'm showing you the way, and the way is to recognize your connection to the all of which I am, to which I am already associated, or whether I am the all. My own take is to see it as a variation of a form of omniscience, but Jesus is clearly a distinct spiritual being in Thomas.
Okay, that's really helpful, because I've always been interested in that particular statement and its implications for the worldview that the Gospel of Thomas has. So it's interesting to find out that there is some diversity of interpretation on that.
Oh, absolutely.
I want to ask you about something that we talked about earlier, at least we mentioned, but perhaps we should address it more directly, and that is this claim that you have all these different versions of Christianity out there, and the New Testament just happens to be the version that won. And you've already addressed this from the origin side of it, which is to say that New Testament Christianity is the original form of Christianity taught by the apostles, originating from the teaching of Jesus himself, rooted in Old Testament Jewish worldview and religious beliefs. Whereas the Christianity of the these other Gospels, the Gnostic type of interpretation, is really a later derivative interpretation. And I think that's very helpful for people to hear. But I'd like to ask you to attack it from the other end, if you could, which is, all right, in the 4th century, when you have people drawing up lists of books that should belong in the New Testament, the claim is often made that the powers that be imposed on everybody the list that we find today in our New Testament and suppressed these other books, and that this is really a political victory for the Orthodox rather than an intellectual or spiritual victory. Could you address it from that angle?
Sure can. Now, this is more complex because, again, the issue here is, when are we talking about? What time period are we looking at when we ask this question? There's no doubt that by the time we get to the 4th century, Constantine is in place, the Council of Nicaea has met, the canon is being not only named but recognized as the canon, that there also went out at the same time, particularly towards the latter part of that century, efforts to suppress these texts. In fact, the reason why the Nag Hammadi texts were found in a jar is someone hid them, because he was afraid they would be destroyed otherwise. So in the 4th century, the idea of suppression and the use of political power and authority is completely true. But, again, the question is when. When we come back to the 3rd century or the 2nd century or the 1st century, Christianity is not a very powerful faith. It is being persecuted. It is the minority faith, definitely, in the Roman Empire. And what the discussion of the canon, the recognition of the books, never tells you is this. Yes, the list was debated in terms of what goes into the New Testament up until the 4th century. But the first things to be decided upon were the four Gospels, Acts, and the Epistles of Paul. And we know that those were decided upon and recognized by the end of the 2nd century. So to simply say canon 4th century, therefore Gospels were decided late, is a misrepresentation of that history. The real history is the first things to be recognized were the four Gospels. We know that by 180 they're operating as a distinct and recognized collection. And then it was the little books of the New Testament that got debated into the 4th century. So that pushes our window way, way, way back into a period when the church did not have political power, but what was being recognized was simply the theology that's contained within the church. And we can actually trace that. We can actually work through the works of the first and second centuries, and we can see a consistent theology in a myriad of texts that we possess that reflect what the Gospels are teaching as well.
Now, as I understand it, when you look at these debates in the fourth century about the extent of the New Testament canon, and they're talking about books that didn't make it, they're talking about books that are more or less in the same theological tradition as the New Testament books, but just were not regarded as apostolic in origin, as divinely inspired. Books like Shepherd of Hermas, maybe First Clement, books like that. They were not. There was no serious debate in the 4th century about the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Peter or the Gospel of Philip
or the Gospel of Judas.
In fact,
Origen in the early 3rd century is saying we don't recognize, there are certain books that we don't recognize. We don't read in the churches. That's how you knew whether a book was recognized
right.
or not. And he names two Gospels, and the two Gospels that he names are Matthias. We don't have that work, so we don't know what's in it. And the second one, interestingly enough, is Thomas, the most famous, the most elevated of these extra-biblical Gospels in the discussion today. And he's saying, 110 years before the Council of Nicaea. We don't read that in the churches.
So really, to claim that the 4th century church created some kind of innovation by suppressing these books misrepresents the historical sequence. It had already been decided centuries earlier that those books were really not part of the New Testament.
At least a century and a half to 2 centuries earlier. That's right.
Let's kind of sum this up for people who would like to get kind of a simple bottom line on this. What makes the New Testament Gospels superior to the Gospels that are labeled these missing or extra Gospels? How are the New Testament Gospels superior? And I realize they may be superior in more than one way, but what would be some of the main points that you'd want people to go away with as to why we can trust the New Testament Gospels and should trust them over something like the Gospel of Thomas?
Well, the major element here is the rootage that they have. If you can think of a literary text as having a genealogy, okay? Its genealogy goes back through the apostles, who, of course, walked and talked with Jesus. So that would be the major feature. You know, the other thing that's a part of this discussion that we haven't raised, but that's good to raise here, is that what's going on in this period while the New Testament is in the process of being recognized is there's still theology being taught in the churches. And it may not be taught through a conscious canon of four Gospels, Acts, Paul's epistles, and the rest, but what it's being taught through is the presentation of theological summaries, some of which we see embedded in books that ended up in the New Testament, which means that material is older than the time when those works were written, as well as hymns that were being sung on a regular basis in church, as well as rites that were being performed in the church that explained theology, the Lord's Supper and baptism. And when you put that all together, you get a core theology. And so, if I can say it this way, because most people don't think about this, before there was a New Testament, there still was an apostolic theology. And that apostolic theology was being expressed in these summaries, in these hymns, in these rites, as well as being recorded in the material that ended up in the New Testament. And they cohere. And so all the New Testament is an inscripturation of this apostolic theology, which, of course, is why this material was chosen, because it was viewed to reflect the apostolic theology.
Sure.
Well, and this should be what people who call themselves Christians want. They should want to be following the teachings of Jesus learned through his closest associates, passed down orally and then in writing, and preserved for us in the New Testament. And, you know, people are free to believe whatever they want. I don't want to tell people you can't believe that if you don't, you know, that you have, or you have to believe what I believe. But I wish people would stop calling things Christianity that really are not following Jesus Christ, that are not really historically and intellectually and spiritually connected to what Jesus stood for. And frankly, the Gnostic Gospels don't qualify in that sense. They are not adhering to the teachings of Jesus. They are not rooted in the Old Testament faith of Jesus and his Jewish disciples. They don't seem to even fit in the same general cultural milieu. And yet people want to, if I can use this term, resurrect these Gospels and say, we want this to be legitimated as a valid form of Christianity. And I wish people would just knock it off and say, you know what, I'm not a Christian. I don't follow Jesus. I have a different interpretation of what religion is supposed to be all about. And it's, you know, I can kind of co-opt Jesus into it from my point of view, but I recognize this isn't what Jesus and his original disciples actually taught. Unfortunately, what we have people doing in divinity schools and departments of religion all over this country is claiming that they are teaching what Jesus and the apostles taught, or at least one version of what they taught that's just as good as any other. And I think that's an intellectually dishonest claim.
Well, I think that's right. You know, the important thing to say here is that we're dealing with some people who are teaching in religion programs across the country. This isn't everybody, but
that's true.
A significant group, and it's a significant group that's getting a lot of airtime. And so from that standpoint, people need to be aware of it.
Absolutely. Dr. Buck, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on this important subject. I've really appreciated your insights, and I hope that we can do this again.
Well, it's my pleasure, and any time.
All right. God bless.
God bless.
Everyone, thank you for listening. I would encourage you to get a hold of Dr. Daryl Bach's book, The Missing Gospels. That's Daryl Bach, B-O-C-K, The Missing Gospels. The subtitle is Unearthing the Truth Behind Alternative Christianities. This is a very informative book. You'll learn a lot about things that you didn't know about, probably. Even people who have a lot of familiarity with the subject will learn a lot, I think, from reading this book, The Missing Gospels. You've been listening to 4truth.net.